This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, today we're going on quite an adventure. You may think you know something about Stonehenge, and you probably do. We know that it's solar, has a solar alignment. We know that there's some sort of a calendar involved, but there is so much more that remains undiscovered or remained undiscovered until now. Graham Phillips has been on Dreamland before. He's a historical investigator. He's the author of 14 books, The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant. We've talked about that. The Lost Tomb of King Arthur. I believe we've talked about that too, Graham. But now we're going to talk about Stonehenge and the whole megalithic culture that surrounded it in a completely new way. Welcome to Dreamland, Graham Phillips.
Thank you very much for having me on again. It's great to be back.
Well, it is good to have you back, and it is always exciting because you really are one of the best investigators out there. But I have to tell you, when I picked this up and I thought, oh, not another Stonehenge book, I was floored by what I found inside. Absolutely floored. And folks, we're going on a really fascinating journey today. You will not have been down this road before. Now, Graham, I want to set the scene just before we begin. We're going to go back to 3000 BC to Britain and that island at that time, heavily forested. Can you tell us a little bit about how many people lived there then?
Well, 5,000 years ago, nobody really knows, but it wasn't much more than 50 to 100,000 people throughout the whole of the British Isles. The numbers keep changing when archaeologists discover more, but it wasn't very many. And the situation was they were in a period called the Neolithic Age, which basically means the New or Late Stone Age. People had stopped being hunter-gatherers, but they still used Stone Age tools made from bone, flint, and, you know, no metal had been smelted in Britain yet. And so it's the Stone Age. But they weren't hunter-gatherers anymore. They'd settled in communities, and they developed simple farming techniques, and they had domesticated animals. So there were simple farming communities living in huts, round huts, which were built from stone, circular stone huts with a thatched roof. And perhaps these communities would only have a couple of hundred people in them. And they were spread throughout England, Scotland, Wales, and Ireland. And this is the period we're talking about.
This is an area which was very sparsely populated compared to today. A single neighborhood in London has more than 100,000 people in it. How many man hours were involved in the building of Stonehenge?
Well, Stonehenge has got quite a lengthy history. It starts off around 3000 BC as a simple circle of stones, perhaps 60 stones, in a larger circle than the Stonehenge we know today. But these stones are about 6 feet high. And what happened is that around 500 years after that was built, the Stonehenge we know today was erected. In other words, a circle of stones, very big stones, the outer stones around 12 feet high, some inner stones up to 20 feet high. And remarkably, across the top of this outer stone circle, for example, you've got lintel stones, stones along the top of them, creating this unique series of arches of which Stonehenge is famous for. And that was erected in that form around about 2500 BC. So it happened over quite a period of time. And so whatever the original stone circle was used for, by the time the Stonehenge we know today was built, there were more people in the country, and therefore they had more labor to use to build the spectacular monument we now know.
And yet it took how long? How long over how many years was from beginning to end did it take to finish the Stonehenge that we know today?
Well, the very original simple stone circle of just simple standing stones without any arches on them and smaller stones, that's quite an interesting history, because archaeologists over recent years have been able to determine that the type of stone that was used to create it was quarried 130 miles away to the west. Stonehenge stands in central southern England, and about 150 miles to the west in South Wales, in the Preseli Mountains, is the only place in the country where you can actually get the type of stone that they built the original stone circle from. And so for some reason, these stones were quarried and moved 130 miles. The thinking now is, because they've actually found the quarries in South Wales where these stones were cut, they've even found some stones in this ancient Stone Age quarry that had been cut, ready to be used to build a stone circle, but had broken and therefore had been discarded. So some of the stones that ended up at Stonehenge were never taken there because they broke, and they still survive in this quarry. And archaeologists have been able to date them. And it's thought that there was originally a stone circle in South Wales, similar to the original one at Stonehenge. And eventually, when central southern England, the forested area, was cleared for farming land, gradually people were chopping down more and more trees, the people of South Wales in the hilly mountainous area, which they were able to build these stone circles where there were no trees, they decided to basically migrate to central southern England and take the stone circle with them. And for years, people have thought, how on earth did they do it? Could they drag these stones on rollers for 130 miles? In fact, it would take much. That's a direct route, 130 miles. You'd have to go round rivers and mountains. You'd be 200 miles of dragging these stones. But now it's thought that they, because where the original stones were quarried was quite close to the sea, it is thought that they were put on large barges and sailed around the coast, up rivers, until they could be within about 20 miles of Stonehenge. And from then, they were dragged across countryside to be erected where they were first built. Now, how many people were involved in that? It must have been a few thousand. I mean, to be able to
it's like these it could have been as much as 5 or 10% of the population of the country.
Precisely. Absolutely. And it's fantastic. Not just the local people who were doing this, because local communities would have just been a few hundred people. It's a large area of people have got together to say, right, we're going to move our stone circle to Pastures New in central southern England. And then when you've got the actual later stone circle, the bigger one they decided to build 500 years later, the one we know now, those stones are huge. I mean, they're got from about 20 miles from where Stonehenge is. They went dragged all the way from South Wales. But to quarry those huge stones and to shape them into such perfect shapes so that you could then erect them and haul other stones on top of them into this continuous ring of arches would have taken perhaps 20,000 people. It depends how long they took to build it. It's thought, based on carbon dating of organic material found beneath the stones by archaeologists, that it may have only taken about 20 or 30 years to do it, which would have required possibly using most of the population of southern England.
You know, I'm silent because it's impossible to believe or understand. Well, it's not impossible to believe because too much work has been done. We know this is what happened, but it's so hard to understand. I mean, can you imagine building something like that now? It's inconceivable. But the other thing is the amount of time involved. How long from the first stone circle to the completion of the whole thing in southern England?
Well, the Stonehenge is about 500 years from the original stone circle to the one we know now, but both of them probably took a few years to build.
But the thing is that
there's no building that, going on in between.
That enormous amount of time. We don't have anything in our culture, or we have, I take that back. We do have things in our culture that go back more than 500 years. Obviously, our religions do. But not in terms of construction. The Gothic cathedrals, some of them took 100 or 200 years to build. But now we never spend that much time, and let alone 500 years.
That's, well, the Gothic cathedrals weren't built using 5 or 10% of the population, that, let alone most of it, in an area. They were built over a long period of time using just a small number of people, relatively speaking, whose job it was to build these things. I suppose something equivalent might be considered the Great Pyramids of Egypt, which were built in the lifetime. I mean, the Great Pyramid was built in the lifetime of the pharaoh who ordered it built. And that would have taken many thousands of people. But the proportion of the population of Egypt that was used to build it is far less than the portion of the population that was needed in England. Also, by the time the Egyptians were building these things, they had a society with a very rigid structure. You've got the king at the top, you've got warriors, you've got leaders, you've got much more sophisticated tools, and you've got a very organized society living in cities. But the people of the British Isles were living basically in mud huts, and they were using, in order to build Stonehenge, they weren't using metal, iron or bronze items. They were using antlers for picks to dig away at the chalk, bedrock. They were using flint or stone axes, and they were shaping the stones with antler picks, and they were digging up the soil with the shoulder blade of various animals.
But wait a minute, Graham. How were they carving the stones?
They carved them. Archaeologists have reconstructed what they did, and teams of archaeologists have been to where the stones were quarried, and they've used the same kind of picks. They haven't spent years doing it, but they've done a certain amount of bashing away until they realize, okay, this has taken X amount of time, so we can calculate how long it would have taken. So it could be done, but what was clever about it, in order to split stones in a completely with right angular corners, it seems that what happened is that they heated the stones and then threw water on them. They created a small crack in the stone by the antlers and stone axes. And then when there was a crack in it, by heating it and then fires underneath and then throwing cold water on it, the sudden contraction of the stone caused it to split along the little ridge they'd already cut. So they were quite sophisticated. So it is possible that they could do it, but it would take a heck of a long time and an awful lot of people to do it.
Yeah, it is a massive undertaking. In fact, in terms of the amount of energy involved and the social energy, the cultural intensity, all of it, the economic effort, it's greater than anything we have ever done in not only in modern times, but I think since the time of the Roman Empire. The only thing that approaches it is the Great Pyramid. And as you said, this was a larger undertaking because it involved more of the population.
And there's a way of this population being controlled. I mean, it's now not thought that they were all slaves that built it, but the workers were organized in a very organized society with a hierarchy, and they were producing vast amounts of food to feed these people. Now, Britain, on the other hand, was isolated communities. They had no infrastructure like roads. They hadn't invented the wheel. They didn't even use animals as beasts of burden at this point. They didn't have horses or oxen or anything else to drag things along or to take them around the country. So they were walking everywhere. They had no real roads, just a few ancient tracks. There is no evidence that there was any kind of organization of society outside the local, basically, clan groups of perhaps 100 or 200 people. So, but somebody or some group of people managed to organize everybody to undertake this vast construction project. Well, why? I mean, the question is, was it just for some religious purpose? If it was, it's way beyond any other religious construction project that's ever been done, as you rightly said. It seemed to me that it must have had some immense practical purpose. The only thing I can imagine today being similar is if we suddenly find out, wow, there's an asteroid going to crash into the Earth in 20 or 30 years' time. We're all going to be killed. There's no way of stopping it. And the world gets together to create some amazing amount, some kind of arc in space to evacuate large portions of the population of Earth. I mean, that would be the equivalent. So I'm thinking, surely there's got to be some sort of practical reason for this thing being built, rather than a religious one. Because if you haven't got an overall control of society, you're not basically going to get the same religion going on everywhere so that everyone says, yeah, we're going to build this because we, you know, we worship the same God. I mean, even when you get the same kind of religions in the modern world, you get different types of those. You get all sorts of different Protestants, all sorts of different, you've got Catholics and, you know, in the Christian church, you Islam is divided into many different sects. There's no way that people are going to work together on one religious project if they're so divided with no central authority. It's a mystery.
Well, of course it is. And we're going to, for our free Dreamlanders, but first, listen up. I'm going to be at some conferences this summer and fall, and you might want to come too. So I think they're going to be quite good. I'm going to be attending two conferences over the next few months. The first is Consciousness and Contact at the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, July 18th to the 22nd. I'm going to be there with Yvonne Smith, Alan Steinfeld, Ananda Bosman, Kevin Briggs, and others. It's a small conference, but it is a very interesting one. It's going to include a traditional Lakota feast. I'm going to be talking about ascension and the afterlife based around my book, The Afterlife Revolution. There's going to be a breakfast and a trip to the Wounded Knee Memorial. There will also be a Sundance. Other speakers will be Cindy Ketches, who will provide an overview of Lakota spirituality, Alan Steinfeld, his research on hybrids, remote viewing, developing multidimensional consciousness. Ananda Bosman will be discussing the 432 healing frequency and what it all means. Yvonne Smith will be talking about abductees. There's going to be a lot going on there. If you want to go, call Mia Ferroleto at 802-952-6217 or email her at mia.ferroleto@gmail.com. That's 802-952-6217 for Consciousness and Contact, July 18 to 22 in the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Then, on October 4th through the 6th, I'm going to be at the Portal to Ascension Conference in Long Beach, California, and along with a very large number of other guests. It's a big conference. Billy Jackson, JJ and Desiree Hertak, Barbara Lamb, Jason Quitt will be there, Alan Steinfeld again, John D'Souza, Michael Tellinger, Ray Hernandez will be there, Travis Walton will be there. As I say, it's a big conference, October 4th to the 6th at the Atrium Hotel in Irvine, California. Find out more at ascensionconference.com. It'll also be the first time I'll be talking publicly about my new book, A New World, which should be published by then. We're talking to Graham Phillips. His new book is Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, The Living Libraries and Healers of Megalithic Culture. And he goes far beyond where anyone has ever gone, I think, before. on this subject. Now, let's back up a little bit, because Stonehenge is not alone, is it?
No, it's the most famous stone circle, and it's the only one with the arches all the way around. It's the most elaborate, but it's only one of thousands of stone circles that are erected throughout the British Isles from around about 3100 BC right up until the first millennia BC. For over 2000 years, these stone circles were erected. Now, Stonehenge is a very large one. Most smaller communities would have probably had a local stone circle of maybe 15 to 20 stones, maybe only 4 feet high, and about, shall we say, 30 to 50 feet in diameter. So we're talking about smaller stone circles, perhaps serving small communities. But there were also where you've got larger numbers of people, not all in one community like cities, but where there's an area of where there's great crop cultivation going on, where it can support large populations. You've got some huge stone circles, some of them much, much bigger than Stonehenge. 20 miles to the north of Stonehenge, there is the biggest stone circle in the British Isles, which is called Avebury. And it is so large that it surrounds an entire village that's now built virtually inside it. It's around about, the diameter of the circle is an astonishing quarter of a mile. And it was surrounded by about 100 huge stones, some of them up to 25 feet high and much bigger than anything at Stonehenge, much wider. And they could weigh up to 50 tons. And inside this outer stone circle, you've got other smaller stone circles built inside it. But it's not just that. Around the stone circle, you have a ditch, a circular ditch, an embankment. The ditch about 30 feet deep and the embankment about 30 feet high. And that's what it is now after centuries, 5,000 years of erosion. So it would have been much bigger in the past. And this ditch and embankment was created, cut out of solid bedrock of chalk. Again, we know that they only use simple stone tools like antlers for picks, as I was talking about with Stonehenge, because the remains of broken ones have been found lining the ditch and found when excavations have taken place into the embankment. So broken tools that were used for it to create it have been found. Now, it seems that the people who lived near Stonehenge decided to go for something that was extremely elaborate and achieve something that no one else seems to have done in megalithic times in Britain. And that's shape the stones very precisely and put the arches around it. The people of Avebury, on the other hand, probably decided we're not going to do that. We're going to impress by sheer size. And it's massive. But it's far less known about as Stonehenge. Far fewer people visit it.
Yes, but I visited. It's a wonderful place, by the way.
And you have been there, have you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it is. It's astonishing. A lot of the stones don't survive anymore, but plenty still do, to give you some idea of what it might have originally looked like. But that undertaking also, because of its sheer size, would have taken more people than Stonehenge to create. And again, they know that it was archaeologists, by being able to date the kind of organic matter found in the rubble around that created the ditch and beneath the stones, you can get a dating not only from carbon dating organic matter, but from something called thermoluminescence. It's a way of dating pottery fragments. And they know from this that it only took between maybe 30, 50 years at the most to create this thing. These were done in the lifetime of the people that lived there. And it's not just the thousands of people that would be needed to build it. It's also the people that were supplying the food for those who were building it and those who were continuing to cultivate the crops needed to feed these people.
And these were still more or less hunter gatherers, because the cereal crops they were growing were primitive and not particularly sustaining, not particularly nutritious. Is that correct?
Well, the thought now is that they must have been, because these people weren't hunter gathering anymore.
They weren't.
Cereal crops. No, there's no way that they could have been hunter gathering and also living in villages. If you're moving from place to place nomadically, you'd be living in teepees or something like the Native Americans of the plains used to live. But these people were settled in villages that archaeologists have determined were occupied for centuries. So obviously, whatever crops they were growing were sustaining them somehow.
Yes, obviously they were. And they must have had meat as well, you would think, or maybe not.
Yes, they did. They had domesticated animals by this point. Animals that were the goats, sheep, wild boar could have been domesticated.
So it was a viable diet.
It was a viable diet. Fish. A lot of these people lived off fish also. The rivers nearby where these communities were heavily stocked with plenty of fish. So there was plenty to eat.
So,
and it was also a much warmer climate back then in Britain than it is now. So the vegetation would have been far more lush.
So they were, there's no mystery about the fact that they were capable of doing this. In other words, the mystery is how they could have allocated so many man hours and involved so many people in doing it. Because after all, somebody had to be farming as well at the same time. And that had to have been a highly organized society.
Well, the thing is, this is it. The mystery is, how is a society so organized to have done this? Not how they built these things. Archaeologists have been able to replicate how this was done. The big mystery is that it would have taken so many people and such organization when the country left no, these people left no indication that they had the kind of organized civilization to be able to do this. And Stonehenge and Avebury were being built before even the Great Pyramids of Egypt were being built. The only places in the world that really had civilization at this point was Egypt, Mesopotamia, which is modern Iraq, and India. And these are the only people that were the very beginnings of civilization. But people throughout the world at this point were beginning to learn farming techniques. But nobody else, apart from in France, in northern France, people started to erect stone monuments that people have called megalithic. Megalith comes from the word megalith, big stone, large stone, from the Greek. And there
like
are megalithic
Karnak in Brittany. Is that what you're talking about?
In Brittany, in
yeah, I've been
France.
There too, and it's nowhere near as impressive as Stonehenge, for that matter, as Avebury.
No, and what's different is, although they did erect standing stones, massive rows of standing stones at Karnak in Brittany, for example, stone circles were unique to Britain. There were small stone rings created, but nothing like the stone circles of Britain. Stone circle building in Britain was completely separate from anything that was going on in megalithic France or other parts of the world. And what shows us that the people, the megalithic people who were building these stone circles in Britain, it was a self-contained thing and had nothing to do with coming from continental Europe, is because archaeology has shown that it didn't start in the south of England, close to the continent, but far north, to the north of Scotland, in a group of islands called the Orkney Isles. That's where the oldest stone circles were built, around 3100 BC. And then it gradually moved south over the next 100 years until you've got the building of Stonehenge. And by this time, you've got hundreds of stone circles being built all over the country. So this idea of building stone circles started off in the north of Britain, and there's quite a large one on the Orkney Isles called the Stones of Stenneth, which the stones there are about 15 feet high. I mean, it's a big stone circle, and it's around about 100 feet more, probably 200 feet across. And that's the first stone circle. And how do they date them? Basically, archaeologists dig underneath the stones. They find organic matter that's there that they can date, so they know which ones were built before others. And then within 100 years, the idea of building stone circles spread throughout the whole of the country. So whatever they were doing building stone circles for, the idea caught on pretty quickly.
Yeah. And we're going to be exploring in this next part of the show just what that idea may have been, because it's very different from what we thought. And I'm not saying that the its use as a calendar was completely irrelevant. It wasn't, but there was more. Free Dreamlanders, we'll be right back.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's revelations, Anne Streber's mysterious powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic ebooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. Plus, a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
Did you know that you can get the Path and the Communion Letters each for $3.99 as ebooks on Amazon? That's right, the Path and the Communion Letters. These are two fascinating books. The Path, of course, I wrote. It is a really unusual insight into the Tarot and what it actually means, something that's probably been hidden there for a long, long time. But when you read it, you realize that the Tarot of Marseille had to be about this because it's so beautifully organized. It was a discovery I made back in the 1970s, and now you can find out for yourself just how powerful a presence in your life and a guide the Tarot can be. The Path, $3.99. The other book I want to talk about is The Communion Letters. If you have not read this, you need to. This is the best book of close encounter and abduction experiences ever created. It was created by Anne Streber. The letters in it are now part of a permanent archive at Rice University, along with thousands of others that she collected. And I have to tell you, it is absolutely unique in the world. Also, $3.99. Don't miss either of these great books. They're terrific. And I'm very proud of The Path. It's unique in the world. And I'm so proud of Anne for having created the Communion Letters, also unique in the world. We're talking to Graham Phillips. His new book, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, The Living Libraries and Healers of Megalithic Culture. This is going to give you a completely new understanding of this ancient culture. And you're going to start to think to yourself, just to do the same thing probably to you that it did to me, that what have we lost? What have we lost? Because this is not about just a calendar. This is about an entirely different way of living and understanding the world. Graham, let's move on now into, I want to explore Ireland a little bit, because this was happening also, it started a little later in Ireland, didn't it?
Actually, it started later in Ireland than in northern Scotland, but it started in Ireland before England and Wales. So Ireland comes second after Scotland. So it starts in the north of Scotland, and within 50 years of the first stone circle being built, they're building them on the east coast of Scotland around what's now Dublin. And they started building big stone circles there. And then after this, the idea seems to have come across from Ireland. People could, they had boats, they had simple sailing vessels and canoes. And these people were going backwards and forwards across the Irish Sea to Britain quite regularly. They brought the idea then to Wales and England, and by about 3000 BC, it had caught on over here. So Ireland is kind of earlier than it comes to England and Wales.
Well, you know, I think what I meant to say is I wanted to go to Northern Scotland because that I got mixed up. I wanted to go to where it actually started and to let you describe for us when it started there and what was built.
Well, the first stone circle consisted of simple, well, quite well-shaped, high standing stones, up to 15 feet high in a circle. I can't remember the exact diameter now, but it's a couple of hundred feet across. So quite a large stone circle. But it only consisted of, I think if I remember right, they think around about between 17 and 20 stones originally. Now, what's astonishing about this first ever stone circle, if anyone wants to look it up online, they are called the Stones of Stenness. It's the very first stone circle that archaeologists have determined was built. It's built on an island called Mainland on the Orkney Isles, just off the coast of northern Scotland. But within about 8 miles, I think it is, away from where that stone circle was built, astonishingly, there is an almost perfectly preserved village dating from the time that the stones were erected. It's called Scarra Brae, and it's on the coast of the mainland isle, and it consists of about 20 dwellings. It was covered up by a sandstorm going back many hundreds of years, and around, I think it was around about 2500 BC, I can't remember the exact date now, when it was covered by a freak storm under the sand. And like a kind of British Pompeii, it was excavated by archaeologists over recent years. And we know how these people lived. It's fascinating because they built these circular huts beneath the ground level. So they dug out holes. They then had these circular holes that they built walls around the earth, around the holes. And so they lived underground. And then there was a thatch or skin roof put over the holes where these people lived. And each of these dwellings was connected by an underground tunnel. Why did they live underground? Well, because they were on the windswept islands of the Orkneys, it was the best way to keep dry and warm. And astonishingly, because it was covered by sand for so long, even the furnishings these people had, simple stone furnishings, still survive. You go there and you can see shelving made of stones. You can find beds, a kind of stone box, which said are filled with seaweed or straw to form a mattress. The remains of fires, all of the pottery that these people use. It's almost like the Mary Celeste. These people fled when the storm came. There was no, as far as I know, there was no bodies found there, like a Pompeii that was covered by a volcano. But so these people had time to get out, but they'd lost their village. But all their belongings and how they lived is perfectly preserved. So we know how the people who built the first stone circle actually lived. And other people later that were building stone circles had pretty much the same kind of huts, except elsewhere in the country, they didn't build them below the ground.
This is a world that is basically full of stone, all kinds of stone. Menhirs, megaliths, long barrows are being built all over the area during this long period. All of them built, painstakingly built, with very heavy stones and using equipment that we just some of it we actually don't really understand. I don't think we really understand how the stones were transported to Stonehenge, for example, do we? I mean, we know what was done, but we don't know the materials used.
No, it's only guesswork. You're absolutely right. Nobody really knows. All we know, it was done somehow.
We know it was an enormous undertaking, but this was basically a world which was devoted to the use of stone and the building of stone monuments and of all kinds. Even their housing was stone. It's different from the Stone Age in Europe, when on the continent there was nothing like this level of building and complexity at all.
There was nothing like this kind of sophistication that was going on in the British Isles, anywhere outside Egypt, Mesopotamia, and northern India.
They were very different. Do you think they had any contact, for example, with Egypt?
Some people have suggested that they couldn't have done all this unless some Egyptians had sailed over and arrived on the Orkney Isles, and then it spread out from there. But if they had come from Egypt, well, one thing that Egypt had got going for it that they hadn't got in this country is it was in the Bronze Age by the time places like Stonehenge was built. So they were able to create things because they had metal implements. We see no evidence. I mean, a few people were trying to make bronze, and you've got people smelting copper, but no instruments were made, no tools, no weapons or anything like that. If the civilization of Egypt, for example, had had any part to play in creating the stone circles of Britain, we'd have found bronze instruments, tools, whatever, and we haven't. Also, the way that the lintel stones, the arch stones, the ones that go across the other standing stones at Stonehenge, are put together, so that they don't slide off, they've created something which is a development taken from woodworking. They've created a joint to hold the stones where they are, which doesn't show any previous working of stones in that particular way to create arches. They've sort of thought it up themselves because they're using a rather primitive form of way of keeping the stones on top based on woodworking joints. Whereas if the Egyptians had done it, it would have been more sophisticated.
You know, interestingly, one of the interesting things you point out in the book is that there was more than one culture involved in this over the years. Can you tell us, for example, a little bit about the coming of the beaker culture?
Yeah, it's the first people are these original Neolithic people. A lot of people over the centuries were migrating to Britain on boats. The sea levels were lower then because it was not as long after the Ice Age as we are now. And it was easier to get across the English Channel from France and the Netherlands and places than it is today. And also the weather was much better, so they didn't have the kind of storms generally, except for perhaps the freak ones like the one that covered that village of Scarborough Brae. But generally speaking, you're going to get across the water easily enough in simple boats. So migrations came across from Europe. And by around about the time that the Stonehenge we now know was being built, 2500 BC, another group of people came from what is now the Netherlands, known as the Beaker people. They're called that because they buried their dead in a slightly different way to the earlier Neolithic people. The Neolithic people tended just to bury their dead and then put a mound over where important people were buried, with not really many grave goods. The Beaker people, however, tended to do the same sort of thing, but build a deliberate pit in which they put the body, and the body would be there. Somebody would be, the skeletons have been found holding beakers, in other words, a pottery vessel. And there's obviously some religious significance in this. So they're known as the Beaker people because of the distinctive way they buried their dead. So we know this new group of people came, and DNA testing on the bones show that they're a new group of people to arrive in Britain. But they went, they didn't invade, they basically merged with the society that was in Britain.
But they retained their own culture. They didn't.
Absolutely. They kept burying their dead in the same way.
Right. And there's no sign that there was any warfare or anything like that. It wasn't an invasion.
No, there is no. I mean, how that they would know that there's no. I mean, we must remember, I think it's important to point out, that this is way before the age of writing. These people never developed any form of writing. We know what the ancient Egyptians did because they had writing. These people didn't develop any form of writing. The first time there's any writing in Britain is when the Romans turn up, 3,000 years after these first stone circles were built. Now, when these Beaker people arrived, we don't know. We haven't got any writings to tell us what happened, but archaeologists have found no evidence anywhere of people dying in any way that's associated with battle and conflict. Like, for example, finding a skull smashed in by a blunt instrument. These people weren't creating any kind of weapons that were useful for anything other than hunting. So there's no evidence that there was any kind of fighting going on, either between communities or with these new people. But when the Beaker people arrived, it wasn't as if they suddenly thought, oh, wow, stone circle building, that's great, and we'll give up our religious practices, for example, burying the bodies with beakers. You can always really tell a distinctive feature of religions is how people dispose of their dead. And so they obviously kept going with the same religion. But we know from the kind of people who are buried around the settlements near places like Stonehenge, that the Beaker people and the original Neolithic people were living side by side and both working on the stone circles together. So a new religion comes along. They don't give up their own religion, but they still help build stone circles, which is an indication that stone circles were not used primarily for a religious function, but for something practical.
Something else was going on, and we're going to be starting exploring that in a minute. Now, after the Beaker people come, the Wessex people come, then, and these peoples are all coming because of the fact that it's warming and they come from low parts of Europe, which are slowly flooding. But then it changes, and the weather gets much colder, and people from farther, deeper in Europe start to show up because they're looking for warmer temperatures. And what happens then? They still, do they not, remain involved with the stone circles?
Absolutely. What's fascinating is you've got the arrival of the first Celtic people to the British Isles. Ireland's known for its Celtic population, so is Wales and Scotland and Brittany in northern France. But these people originally came from what's now Germany and Austria. And as you say, from around about 1200 BC, they start to migrate north into France, Holland, and across to Britain. And they are completely different. They have got metal, not just bronze. They bring the Iron Age to this country. They are quite a warrior caste of people. They build hill fortifications. There's no evidence that in Britain until the arrival of the Celts, anybody here ever built any kind of fortifications around their settlements, which is another indication of no fighting in a very peaceful civilization.
A very peaceful civilization for thousands of years.
It had been going on for at least 2,000 years by the time the Celts started arriving. The original Celts that arrived were Bronze Age in around 1200, but by 700 BC, they have developed iron. They're in the Iron Age, and they're quite a warrior caste of people. But even when they arrived, for many years, archaeologists thought, well, once the Celts arrived in Britain, they subdued the stone circle builders, and that was the end of stone circle building. But now, through modern dating techniques, improvement in dating techniques, archaeologists have been able to determine that the stone circles didn't stop being built and repaired when the Celts arrived. They continued to be used, built, repaired. Stones that had toppled were put back up. How do they know? Because they can date what lies underneath the stone to when a stone's put in place, in order to stop it sinking much further into the earth. Usually the people who built them would lay a a level of broken pottery or bones underneath, animal bones underneath the pit, at the bottom of the pit. They'd line the bottom of the pit with items that are their organic matter, which can be radiocarbon dated. So
right.
They now know through latest radiocarbon techniques that the stone circles continued to be built right through the Celtic period. Even though the Celts were warlike, built hill forts, fought each other, they, when they arrived, thought, oh, we like stone circles too. And they certainly didn't change their religion, because they were making a lot of religious artifacts out of metal, and those still survive.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take another brief break. When we get back, we're going to start to talk about maybe the real reason that these circles were built. Then later, in the third segment of the show for subscribers, we're getting down deeper into the significance of the Druids, the mysterious Druids that I think Graham has come to understand more deeply than most previous researchers ever have, and ley lines and the significance of the placement of all of these stones. We'll be right back.
When should you subscribe to UnknownCountry.com? How about right now? Go to UnknownCountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
You've probably heard the music for years. It's the theme song for Dreamland. But you may not know the name of the piece, The O of Pleasure. Or the name of the composer, Ray Lynch. Ray Lynch is a 3-time Billboard Award winner. Ray is also the composer of the platinum album, Deep Breakfast. Pandora calls Ray one of the most influential artists in New Age pop and adult alternative circles. For music that will move your heart and set your spirit soaring, visit www.raylynch.com.
Earthfiles.com is Linda Moulton Howe's great website offering news of the edge of science and reality. Keep up with Linda's work every single day on earthfiles.com.
We're talking to Graham Phillips. His new book, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, The Living Libraries and Healers of Megalithic Culture. Now, Graham, why libraries? Why do you say that?
Yes, that's okay. We have to go back to the beginning. When the original Stonehenge was built, the first stone circles. Throughout the period of, now we know, almost 3,000 years of building stone circles on the British mainland, from about around 3000 BC up until the Romans first started arriving, initially with an abortive invasion by Julius Caesar, 55 BC, till the Romans decided they were definitely going to invade during the time of the Emperor Claudius, in 43 AD. So you've got a period from 55 BC where the Romans start to come to Britain. They start to trade with the British, and then they eventually invade them. So we've then got writings about what the people in Britain were doing. So we know something about them then. But this is the Celtic culture. But remember, as I was just saying, they're still building using stone circles. Now, who are the people who are organizing all this? There's got to be a group of organizers, a group of people who are a priesthood or an elite caste of people who are responsible for directing all this work and using the stone circles. Now, we've said that there had been a number of different migrations to Britain before the Celts, like the Wessex culture, the Beaker people, and these various people continued to bury their dead in their own particular way. The original megalithic people had their way of burying the dead, usually just in the ground with sometimes a mound over it. the Beaker people really liked building mounds, but the bodies were buried under the ground. The Wessex culture started burying their dead inside a mound, not under the ground. So they'd build a mound, put people inside it. But throughout this whole period, there is one specific type of tomb that is being built all the time and doesn't change. And it's known as a box tomb. Now, what this was a structure that was about perhaps 8 feet wide and about 15 feet long, built above ground level of stone. So you've got like stone walls, but they're made out of large slabs of stone. And there's a big box about 5 feet high, if you like, a rectangular box and of stone. And in the middle of this, it's divided into two chambers, partly by another stone across the middle. And in one side of this box, one of the chambers, there was buried the bodies, not just one, but a series over many generations. And in the other side, they would put grave goods. And then over, what would happen is that there would be slabs placed along the top, over the top of this box. And then a mound was built over it of rubble and earth and then covered in grass. So you end up with a mound, but with an entrance at one end, so that sealed with a removable stone so that more burials could be placed there over years. Now, these are built very often right next to, sometimes adjacent to stone circles or nearby. And therefore, it seems that whoever was being buried in these box tombs near stone circles was an important group of people, probably those responsible for whatever was going on at stone circles. We know this because of their grave goods, that a lot of these other people didn't have apart from simple pots, as I said, like the Beaker people. But these grave goods included religious items, beads and things like this, that suggest that these people were of a priestly caste rather than a military caste of people. There was no weapons. But in addition to that, there were found items that seem only to be able to be used for some kind of surgical practices, saws made of bone and then later by the Celtic period of metal, thin needles that would have been no good for sewing animal skins, but would have been useful for sewing up wounds. Other items like thin knives that just would have been useless for doing anything other than perhaps being used as scalpels. So it seems that these people are being buried with primitive medical kits. And more astonishingly than that, there are lots of pottery bowls and vessels have been found in these box tombs that archaeological analysis, scientific analysis has shown that once contained various substances that seem to have been used as medical potions, various natural remedies for things such as parasites, for plants that had been used for antiseptics and for gargles for sore throats and analgesics for pain relief. And so it seems that you've got these medical kits being buried with these people, as well as religious items, perhaps, suggesting that this caste of people who were responsible for whatever was going on in stone circles, because they're buried right by them and nobody else is, were also healers. Now, the wisdom keeper bit, what's that? Okay, so you've got the healer part. These people, whatever else they were doing at stone circles, were the healers, the physicians of the time. And these box tombs were built right the way from 3000 BC all the way through until the Romans arrived and put a stop to the whole thing. And we know from Roman writings something about the people that were buried in these box tombs. They called them the Druids. Now, until recently, people have thought, archaeologists and historians have thought, the Druids were the Celtic priesthood. They only arrived around 700 BC to Britain and therefore had nothing to do with the original stone circle builders. Yes, these people were Celtic, but because they were being buried in the same way and in the same tombs, as the predecessors in the megalithic period, it seems that the Druids were the Celtic successors of those who'd been using the stone circles for centuries. So whatever the Romans tell us the Druids were doing is probably what had been going along all the time. Druids today, there are Druids that people say, well, the Druids, everybody knows they use Stonehenge. They still do it today. The Druids who meet at Stonehenge today are modern orders of Druids, a little bit like Freemasons and a cross between Freemasons and New Age pagans. They were only really founded, the first modern Druid orders in the 1700s, and have got very little to do with the original Druids. And people said, well, the Druids didn't use Stonehenge. That was, they had nothing to do with it, and said that these Druids have got no business practicing their rituals at Stonehenge on Midsummer's Day. Well,
yeah, I remember when I was a young man, I lived in England in the 60s, and I saw the Druids, modern Druids, coming to Stonehenge when you could. It was just open then; it wasn't a tourist attraction. To get to it, you stopped on the bus on the way to Salisbury. Stopped there, if you asked,
and you could wander around it.
Oh, you walk around in it. Yeah, absolutely. It was unoccupied. There wasn't even a guard there. But there was a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of vandalism. And over time, the Stonehenge itself probably wouldn't exist anymore if it hadn't been fenced off, because so many people would take, especially the blue stone, which is the second circle after the outer circle, they would chip off pieces of it, and you could see it was getting smaller. So, unfortunately,
yeah, if they hadn't have put a fence around it and had guards and everything like today, it would probably wouldn't be much left of it. But people said, well, the Druids have got no business being there. Well, even though they might be a modern reinvention, it seems like the Druids did use stone circles, and that they were the successors of those who had been using it in megalithic times. Remember, I said that
when we come back, folks, I'm sorry, Graham, but we're coming to the end of this segment. We're going to be talking more about the Druids, and then we're going to be getting into the question of ley lines and what they are and how they connect the different stone circles in the region, and how it is that the people of those days could even detect or be aware of these lines of energy, as it were, and what maybe can we do to re-engage and reconnect with our planet in such a way that we begin to become part of its life again, because we have lost our relationship with the planet. We don't feel its presence anymore, for the most part, and certainly not in the Western world. Well, Free Dreamlanders, it has been great having you with us as always. Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge, the living libraries and healers of megalithic culture, well worth your time. A wonderful adventure, beautifully illustrated, by the way, full of color photographs. And it really does bring the past to life in a whole new way. And not only that, a way that is helpful to us in our understanding of the world around us and of what we are in it. We can reconnect with the earth. It is possible to do that. Subscribers, we will be back right now.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.